I'm Asha Nayaswamy, and here we are with our morning broadcast. We're into April now, and we passed April Fool's Day, and nobody said this was a joke, so here we are. I was hoping maybe that God would just sort of do a big reveal and say, well done, children, and then send us back to our lives, but it's not going to happen. I had an extremely interesting experience this morning, which is, of course, bears directly on our whole lives at the moment. Dr. Peter Van Houten has been guiding Ananda through this pandemic because he's a medical person and he's also a Kriyacharya and a founding member of Ananda from 45 years ago. In Palo Alto, we're also extremely fortunate because Dr. Shanti Rubinstone is also one of our spiritual leaders here, and her medical and her spiritual knowledge have been wonderful. She's been working with Dr. Peter very closely all the way through. Dr. Peter himself, just to say it, Dr. Peter came to Ananda Village right after he'd finished medical school, but before he started his residency, and he had some question in his mind about, now that he'd found the spiritual path, I believe I'm saying this accurately, whether or not he should continue with medicine. And Swami told him that definitely medicine was his dharma and he should do it. Dr. Peter had been an extremely promising medical student because he's brilliant and dedicated, and his professors expected him to become a prominent research doctor, and I think he more or less saw himself in that light. But after he found the spiritual path and found Ananda, instead of going into some, you know, high prestigious postgraduate like doctors do, he went and did his residency in Stockton, California, so that he could be near Ananda and actually serve by having a small meditation group. Some of his story is told in Swami Kriyananda as we have known him. And then when he was done with that, he came back to Ananda Village and soon opened a medical clinic, not just for the community, but for the entire area, the Sierra Family Medical Clinic, which he's been running now for decades, serving about, I think, 3,000-5,000 patients, not just the community, but the whole area. He actually eventually did come into national prominence, winning some at least one prestigious award, maybe more than one, for his family practice. And so now here we are in this incredible situation, and he's been, first it was daily, and now it's 3 times a week. He does a broadcast for the Ananda community, and it's just kind of helping us all keep in touch with medical information and everything that we need to know. I've been fortunate to know Dr. Peter and be a friend of his since the beginning, and so I've been quite attentive to his broadcasts. Also, I do have, thank you God, the benefit of Shanti Rubinstone, who's equally well-connected and equally tuned in, and so with her input and then also watching Dr. Peter. So Dr. Peter will talk for an hour in a very, you know, measured way, giving us lots of information, giving us expectations, guidelines, so on like this. And every time I talk to him and find out how many more thousands of people are infected in this country and what we can expect, and no, there's not going to be a vaccine, and yes, this is a problem, and, you know, yes, we're peaking here, and no, this, you know, it's just none of the news is good news. But I always feel better after I listen to him rather than worse, because you sort of feel like there's a, this is happening, but it's within human comprehension, and it has it's medicine, it's science, and it's spirit, and it's all there. Well, yesterday various things happened, and I didn't get around to watching the video, so they also send up a written summary. So this morning, I just opened the summary, and I read, you know, where the pandemic is, how many people are dying, how many people are sick. I read that they expect in, I think, California, maybe they meant the U.S., but certainly here, they don't expect it to peak for another month. And then the paper was saying, you know, just because it's peaked, we tend to think, oh, once it's peaked, it's over. No, that just means we have the whole rest of it. So anyway, exhale, everyone. We're going to be here for a while. But here was what was so interesting to me. When I finished reading all of that, and I didn't even read every word, I felt so nervous. I just felt so anxious about, I was thinking of, you know, what it meant when 5,000 people have died, when 1 million people are sick. It just, all of it, And what I realized was I didn't have Dr. Peter's consciousness with me. And it was so dramatic to me how facts are so different from truth and how consciousness is everything. I could have said those words before I had that experience and I knew they were true, but exactly the same information. And it was even like I could tell from the way it was written that it was Dr. Peter's syntax. It wasn't like the words were more inflammatory. It was exactly what he said, that people just took pieces of it. But I didn't have his consciousness. I didn't have his voice and his face and his years of Kriya Yoga practice and his compassion for human suffering. I didn't have it. I just had facts on the paper. And I thought, whoa, I'm never going to do that again. If I can't listen to Dr. Peter's voice, I'm not going to just read this information. But it told me again how exceedingly important consciousness is. I mean, that's about as obvious a statement as I could possibly make. But just one more reason why, as we shelter in place, and if we're going to be in this for many more weeks, which it seems like we're going to be, we have to take very serious responsibility for the environment, the mental environment, the physical environment, the spiritual, the emotional environment that we create for ourselves. Because the facts are just going to be the facts. But whether we experience them as fearsome, whether they take energy from us, leave us neutral, or actually inspire us with greater determination, all depends on the vibration we're living in and the delivery system of those facts also. On one level, what difference does it make? You know, because of all the facts, pretty soon we're all really going to be required to wear masks and all sorts of other things. It helps to know, but the facts themselves don't change the responsibility we have within our lives. The facts, I like to know facts because it helps give me strength to do what I need to do. See, I want to keep two thoughts connected here. Okay. When I was trying to think of a title for today's talk, we were calling it Faith, and I may or may not get to that subject. If I don't, we'll change the title. But the other thing I wanted to call it was Environment is Stronger Than Willpower. Now, the global environment we're living in is one of ill health and extreme concern and kind of helpless fear. So there's a strong environment that's trying to influence us both to accept sickness and to accept anxiety. And so we have to be aware, one, that that's the soup that we're swimming in right now. I'm going to back up a little on this. Environment is stronger than willpower is a phrase of a very well-known phrase of Masters. And he even said, whether your consciousness goes upward toward God or outward and downward toward the world depends on the company you keep. Now, many people don't have a choice about the company they keep. They may be the only person they even know who's interested in spiritual life. You may have family that's not compatible. You may have a job and job compatriots that are not compatible with the spiritual path. So it's not as if Master is condemning you if you can't, you know, have satsang with devotees all the time. Because someone asked Master, he said, well, what if I'm alone, sir? And Master replied, am I not always with you? So the first environment Master is talking about is the environment of our own thoughts and the direction of our own thoughts. You know, we live, there's two very interesting books by a man named Michael Singer. I believe they've both become well-known books, and they should. I met Michael in the 1970s. He came to visit Ananda and to meet Swami Kriyananda at that time. He is a disciple of Master. He's devoted to Paramahansa Yogananda and has done his own wonderful work in Florida. And he wrote these two books. One is called, The Surrender Experiment is one. Soul Journey? Oh, Michael, I have to apologize to you. Soul Journey, I think, or something like that. And the second one is called The Surrender Experiment. You can find in a heartbeat which books they are. They're good books, and I highly recommend them. But I want to steal one of Michael's ideas, which is why I'm talking about this. Michael talked about the fact that someone is always talking inside our head. And he said, and we tend to think that someone talking is us, except if you really think about it, you realize that you're always listening to that someone talk inside your head, which is a clue that that voice that's talking is not actually you. I mean, it was so brilliant and so simple, and that's why I have to give him credit. I wouldn't dare take it. He says, you're living with a constant chattering roommate, is how he put it. And he said, if you're actually living with a roommate who talked all the time, you wouldn't actually take everything that roommate says so seriously, because you would be in a position to tell that this roommate is always talking. And you might even remember that what the roommate said yesterday is not what the roommate is saying today, and that a great deal of what the roommate is saying is not helpful and not true. So the beginning of his, I believe this is his first book, when he's sort of just trying to set the stage for us, he's trying to get us to understand that there is a self which is independent of thought. There is an enduring self which is separate from all of the external phenomenon. Again, it's a brilliant, non-sectarian, even non-deistic beginning of the whole path of self-realization. So then all of his writing is what you do once you have established that fact that I am not my thoughts. So bringing it back over to the way that I'm accustomed to articulating these ideas more, Master says in Autobiography of a Yogi, thoughts are not individually rooted, they're universal. And they're universal, representing universal states of consciousness, vibratory rates from complete delusion to absolute freedom and wisdom. And whatever our vibration is, we tune into that strata and then we receive those thoughts. We are a radio receiver. People don't even have radio receivers anymore, so nobody even knows what that is. But there used to be something called tuning your radio, where you would get to a certain vibration and then you would get the station. And if you moved off that vibration, you would either get a different station or you would just get static. And so it was a very graphic image of how to attune. I'm sort of going like this because I am old enough to have had this big console radio with the thing across it. Was this really fine piece of furniture my parents had, and we would tune it, and then we would get the radio station. So that's what we're doing all the time, but we're unconscious of it. We think that the thoughts that come to us are us. So if we're on a vibration of depression, we get all these thoughts to make us feel depressed. If we get on a vibration of fear, we get all these thoughts that make us feel fearful, and the more thoughts we have that make us feel fearful, the more fearful we become. The more we're stuck on that vibration, the more come into it. Like when a person is depressed, for example, they have all these reasons why they should be depressed. But if their mood lifts for some reason, no conditions have changed. They just suddenly receive thoughts that tell them something different about reality itself. Because reality exists simultaneously on all these levels. It's just a matter of what we choose to tune into. So above all, the environment Master is speaking of is the inner environment that we keep. Do we think we're alone, or do we constantly keep the company of saints? And do we? And then I'm going to move out from that into at least a little bit of the external environment we live in. You know, what are we looking at every day? What is the art on our walls? When we wake up in the morning, what's the first thing we see? You know, what is our house disorderly? Are the colors in our house dark and depressing? Now, of course, right now we can't do much about a great many things. And those of you who are accustomed to going out to work but are now home with your children, and your children are accustomed to going to school and now they're home with you, there might be a little more disorder in your environment than we might be used to, because you have a schoolroom and a playroom. Or you have yourself have set your office up in your living room. I mean, we can't deal with all these things. But what we can deal with is what our eyes fall upon. In the house that I live in, I have spiritual images everywhere. And I have a little bit of other art, but very, very little. And the little that I have, I make sure that it's very uplifting. So pretty much everywhere my eyes fall in my house, starting from when I first wake up in the morning, I look at something that's God-reminding. Now, that's very simple to do. Just look at something that's God-reminding. And so every time you turn your eyes, you see Master, you see Krishna, you see a picture of Swamiji, you see a beautiful seascape, you see a statue. You know, once again, we're not able to influence our environment perhaps as much as we could if we could go out to a store and do something about it. But within the context of what's possible, and given the internet, there's so many resources, we can find things. We want to always be doing something that keeps our vibration uplifted. I mean, I myself noticed just allowing myself to read facts without imbuing it with the consciousness of spiritual confidence that Peter gave to those facts, I was amazed how vulnerable, how suddenly vulnerable I was, whereas I'd been listening to virtually that exact same information for many days, and it had never unsettled me the way it did when I just read it. So we really need to start, we need to pay attention, especially if this is not going to end soon. You know, Dr. Peter was saying that it won't crest for another month. And that means that this is not just like, oh, we can just get along for a few more days. It's like this is going to be a way of life. And so we have to then think about our long-term strategy for positive experience. Now, I will now go to the subject of faith. Somebody actually asked me to talk about it. So I thought, well, I'll talk about faith. I'm going to go to my, you know, ever-present affirmations for self-healing, in which there are 52 different topics. Well, I read through, and unless I made a mistake, and I read through pretty carefully, we have discrimination, truthfulness, happiness, forgiveness. We even have moral vigor. We have good health. We have patience, renunciation, enthusiasm, devotion, high-mindedness. But I didn't find faith. And you would think, now somebody's going to write to me and say I missed it, but I don't think it's here. If I did miss it, then I'll just eat crow tomorrow. But I don't think I did. Okay. It's because I'm now going to give a whole reason why he didn't have it here. Because faith is the result of willingness, devotion, enthusiasm, patience, of all of these things. Faith isn't like an entity that, oh, I need to have more faith. I mean, this is what you say. I need to have more faith. I don't have enough faith. I need to develop faith. So I was going to give you Swami's little paragraph about how to develop faith. And now I know him well enough to know that faith is one of those, you know, big stories that is always out there. So the fact that he neglected to include it, I keep feeling so insecure that, oh my dear, what if it's in here? So let's pretend it isn't, because what I'm saying has validity anyway. It's because faith is the result. Faith isn't something you go out and buy. Faith is something you end up with when you are doing everything you can to live in accordance with whatever you are aspiring to become. Now, that was a long, big sentence. But what that means is we develop the belief, which is not yet faith, that my life would be better if. We have a working hypothesis. That's why Master calls it a science. We have a working hypothesis. I remember when I was 18 or 19, just before I turned 19, and I heard about reincarnation, which was like totally from the moon, in 1966. It wasn't like I'd never heard the word before. Everybody knew it, but it wasn't common parlance like it is now. And I began to really take seriously the idea that reincarnation was a fundamental truth of human life. I was a serious truth seeker, and I'm a yogi for many lifetimes. So as soon as I heard the idea, it was everything clicked into place. But I didn't really know. So it became my working hypothesis. And I began to live my life, try to understand my life, understand my experiences with other people, understand the world around me as if reincarnation were true. The enormous inequities that you see in the world, why would one person be born privileged, one be born handicapped? Why is this person so, you know, effortlessly talented in this particular way? Why this one struggles along? You know, why did I have an instantaneous recognition of this person and after 15 minutes we've been friends for life? Like, how do these things happen? Oh, reincarnation is a really interesting hypothesis that you could apply to these situations, and suddenly you would have an explanation. And so over a period of time, I experimented. I did the scientific experiment of at least trying to use my intuition and my reason to see if reincarnation it would make sense to me. And also I had other thoughts like what you do today, today is the result of yesterday and tomorrow is the result of what you do today. That was the law of karma. So I first understood it. So I began to pay attention to cause and effect in my own life. Then I added reincarnation to it and I thought, oh, maybe the reason these things are happening is because of tendencies I've built up over past lives that are now beginning to express themselves. Oh, isn't that interesting? Karma, reincarnation, it all begins to fit together. Then it was, don't think about yourself and you'll be happy. At the age of 18, I really didn't know there was anything else to think about. It was such an interesting idea. And of course, I began to notice how selfishly I was the center of my universe and how that really didn't serve me. It didn't make me a good friend. It didn't make me happy. It made me totally worried and preoccupied about myself. Again, I conducted the experiment. And gradually I began to learn. And the fourth one, since I've told you three of them, perfect love casts out all fear. Being a very high-strung person, which has been a karma through my whole life, I began to try using love as an antidote to fear, and that too became very interesting. And so that was those were the working hypotheses. And after a time, what happened was, because I was actively testing them mentally, emotionally, in every way that I could constantly test them, I gradually, my belief that it might be true began to turn into knowledge, and that knowledge became faith. But it didn't happen because I wanted faith. It happened because I wanted to test the hypothesis, and I was willing to test it by putting out the energy. In that case, it was mostly mental and emotional energy. But I put out the energy to try to live as if it were true. So what Swamiji has in here is he has all the practices that are required to test the hypothesis that we are children of God and that Divine Mother loves us. But we can't get faith just by saying, give me faith, give me faith, give me faith. We have to get it by exercising discrimination. Resolutely, I quell my inclinations that my mind be open to the wisdom guidance of my soul. And we practice enthusiasm. In everything I do, my enthusiasm soars to embrace infinity. And in his little paragraphs over here, Swamiji gives us the principle of why enthusiasm leads to an experience of our positive relationship to a greater reality, which gives us faith that as part of that greater reality, we are children of God and God will take care of us. So if we lack faith, we need to find a specific, focused way to develop spiritual qualities within ourselves, which will give us experience, and then the faith will come to us. You understand? It's very, very important. You can't just do it. See, what happens to us is we just think. And I had another question. There's another question that's related to this. I was talking about paralyzing self-doubt. When, you know, just trying to be discriminating, but when does discrimination just become paralyzing self-doubt? In other words, I want to have more faith. I can't do anything because I don't have more faith. But I want to have more faith, but I can't do anything till I have any more faith. Well, practice devotion, practice enthusiasm, practice energization exercises. You know, just do something to test the hypothesis, because the only thing that gives us faith is actual experience. We never believe anybody. We don't even believe the saints. We believe the saints enough to conduct the experiment. But just because they say so, in moments of real crisis, just because they say so, doesn't always mean that I believe it, unless I myself have experienced it enough times. A friend was coming to me and she was very worried because her financial situation had become quite precarious all of a sudden. I said to her, because I knew it was true, and she was my peer of my my stage of chronological development, which is what we call this. I'm doing these interviews at noon, on Monday through Friday, with millennials, just because it's very interesting. And so I call them, they are chronologically challenged at this point. I'm chronologically developed, they're chronologically challenged. They're late developers chronologically. But in any case, moving back wherever I was trying to be, oh yes, this woman was my peer, and therefore she had a long life, and I knew it, as a devotee. I just said really simply, has God ever failed to provide for you? I said, I know you've been tested many times, but has God ever failed to provide for you in giving you just what you needed, not necessarily what you wanted, but always what you needed? And she sat, you know, she was honest enough to just sit for a moment. She kind of, you could see she was running through, and I knew her life story, so she was running through a lot of it. And it wasn't just financial, although that was the question at hand. It was raising her children, dealing with her husband who became ill, many different things. And she had to say honestly, no, he's never failed me. I said, well, do you think he's going to fail you now? Do you think he's going to start now? And she said, no, why would he? You see, but that was faith. Faith that was challenged by a difficult circumstance. But she had been practicing long enough and paying attention long enough that there was a lot of experience that could be posited against the doubt. It's not that the doubt won't arise. Even this morning I was frightened by all those statistics. It's not that the doubt won't arise, but if you have experience that you can, posit against it. I'm going to go back to the paralyzing self-doubt in just a moment. I always think of it like this. When we were teenagers, I never did this because this was never, it was so far from who I was, but kids would sometimes hot rod, you know. I lived out in Texas, and there was huge desert. In El Paso, Texas, it was just vast desert. And the teenagers would go out in their cars on these just deserted desert roads, and they would, drag racing, that's what they called it, where they would, you know, go next to each other and try to go fast. I've always felt that my good karma and my bad karma are in a drag race like this, you know, and my bad karma kind of gets ahead of me. My bad karma, meaning all the things that cause me not to follow my own good advice. So I, you know, it's there, and then I'm good, and then I'm bad, and then I'm good, and then I'm bad like that. But I can feel that at a certain point, my good karma is just going to cut over, and that's going to be it. And I've seen a lot of the cars fall away over many years, you know. But somebody takes his place, and we're always at it until we're going to get free. So that's how we build our faith. We just keep putting gas. We keep putting our foot on the gas. We keep doing those things that are going to move us forward. And when this person asked me this question, you know, I want to discriminate. I want to be conscientious. But in fact, as she herself wrote to me, she ends up doing nothing. I said, well, Jesus was asked, how can you tell a true prophet from a false prophet? And then he said, well, you know, a good tree gives good fruit and a bad tree gives bad fruit. And so the phrase became, by their fruits you shall know them. Meaning, just look at what the result is. So when one thinks one is being honest and introspective, but actually all one is doing is going in a circle, you can tell that's a bad practice. And often that going in a circle is just fear of action, fear of making a mistake. I wrote to her that the fear of making a mistake is a far worse mistake than any mistake you might make, and that you have to start fighting the right battle. Because we all make mistakes, but if you get energy moving, you're conducting an experiment. You have a mistake. You find out, oh yeah, that didn't work so well. this is not such a good idea, but energy will start teaching you. If you block the energy out of total fear of action, then you never learn anything. You just go in a circle, and the fruit of that is not good. The fruit of even catastrophic external events is that you're engaged. Something has happened, and now we have some material to work with. Swamiji always said he preferred, you know, a good argument from someone who had energy than a passive yes from somebody who really had no capacity even to follow through on that yes. Because if there's energy in motion, then something can be done. So here we are, you know, confined to quarters, but our consciousness is free. And so we really need to continue to conduct the experiments that will lead us to faith in God, which, given the complexity of all that we're dealing with now, I think that's the best solution to the whole reality. We are part of a greater reality. And let us open our hearts and minds to that spirit. God bless you.